Hey, Sydney.
Hey, Samuel.
I think I finally found a house for myself in my price range. It's in my area. I never thought that I was going to be a homeowner, but I'm really stoked about this new location.
That's exciting. What's it like?
So it is, it's a no bedroom, no bath, 100 square foot place. Right on the waterfront, really easy access to a lot of walkable spots in my neighborhood. It does have the downside of being underneath someone else's floorboards.
No bedroom, no bath. That this is like looking for rentals in New York. That's
It's a no bed, no bath. It is going for $500,000.
I'm glad you're here. Funny timing. I'm gonna get right into the message. I'm gonna tell it like it is, as they say. Oh, I heard a hallelujah. Did you think I don't know what the hell is going on? And a lot of strange places. Where in the hell have you been? Hellfire! 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 All right. Okay, there's something else, too.
Hello and welcome to the Satire Fire podcast, your number one podcast for freaks who like to get in between walls and crawl spaces in order to spy on other people. My name is Samuel.
My name's Sydney. I don't claim that.
Sydney's never once been in someone's walls and it shows. So this week is part two of our series on Notes from Underground by Fyodor Dostoevsky. If you missed last week, that was a plot synopsis of the book. So if you've not read the book or if it's been a while, going back to last week will get you all caught up and ready for this week, which is going to be a context episode. I've done a lot of reading and research and looking in order to get everyone up to speed on what the cultural and societal context was at the time when this book was written. Because we're going to need that context in order to better understand the book, and then in next week's episode, analyze, interpret, rank, rate the book, all of those wonderful things that we're planning on doing next week. But before we get into all of the context that I have spent so much time compiling, this might be a long episode. We'll see. Sydney, have you been up to anything or doing anything that you would like to share with the public?
With the public. I've been, you know, guys, I've been really busy recently in life. Lots of big changes coming in the life of Sydney. But you don't get to know about it because you're the public. No, I'm just
kidding. These are private changes.
But I've been traveling because of these changes. This is so cryptic. It's like, is this what it's like to be an influencer?
Sydney is on the run currently. If you know her location, keep your mouth shut.
No, but I've been traveling. I'm in Tennessee, which is where me and Samuel are from, and I went to a brewery. One thing, okay, so anyone who's ever visiting Knoxville, Tennessee, if you decide to go to the great American city, Knoxville, Tennessee, you should go to a brewery. Like, there's lots of great breweries here. They've kind of gone overboard, honestly, at this point. Like, there's too many, and they don't differentiate much between each other. Some of them are great and are really making strides, but others are just kind of your average brewery. Long story short, there's lots of them, and you should go to one. If you want some recommendations, DM us. I'm sure we both have recommendations. But yeah, I went to a brewery recently that I hadn't been to before, and this is crazy information. I knew this, but did you know that, like, weed is legal in Tennessee now? It's only in certain... So I meant to, like, research the policy because, like, you can get cannabis products in the state of Tennessee now, but you can't get like Delta 9. There's like specific cannabis products you can get and ones you can't. There's laws about it. But like when I was living here, you never could. But at this brewery, they also had a cannabis bar, and it was like you could get cannabis infused drinks, which was just, I didn't do this, but like that's, I've never seen, it was crazy because I'm in Tennessee and I was like, where am I? Like, that just doesn't feel like what I'm used to in Knoxville, Tennessee. But anyways, I'm at this brewery. They've got the cannabis bar. They also have their regular bar. But I had a great time. I made friends with two of the employees there, and we were chatting. One of them spelled her first name the same way I spelled my middle name. Same name, spelled the same way. You guys don't get to know because you're the public. No, you can't get my government name. And then I also met a dog named Knox, and I met like two other dogs. I can't remember their names, but I remember Knox's name because like that's classic for Knoxville. But the funniest part of all this, and I really hope neither of these people listen to this podcast. Sorry, I'm not going to name you or anything, but I met the owner of Knox, the dog, was this man. And he was there with this woman, and I just kind of assumed that they were together, which I just based on vibes, like I did. But then he gets up to go get another drink at the bar. I've been chatting with them, and I lean over to her and I'm like, are you guys like dating? Are you married? Or like what? She's like, oh no, that's my boss. And I was like, oh, okay. And she was like, yeah, it's kind of weird. And I was like, oh. And she's like, but if you're interested in it, go for him. Like, I'll talk you up. And I was like, wait, God, like, what's happening? And so now I'm like so confused about what, I mean, I don't think it's that abnormal to go somewhere with your boss. But I don't know. It was like late. Like it was like 11 p.m. They're at this brewery. Yeah. I'm like, what's this situation? So lots of interesting things at the brewery.
I don't think that it's that weird to be like friends with your boss. I do think that it would be weird to be out and have enough chemistry that strangers assume you're dating.
Yeah.
But also, I guess it would depend on like the industry within which you work. Because I feel like that's less weird the less corporate it is.
That's true. I can't remember what they said they did for work, but honestly it might have just been me. Maybe I was just making assumptions, but I thought it was funny, and I'm like, what are you doing trying to set me up with your boss? what is this
swing and a miss.
Anyways, I think
that would make you their step boss, right?
Mm-hmm. I'm like, you looking for a step boss? Yeah, so those are the interesting Knoxville brewery stories. You guys go out and get your own Knoxville brewery stories and let us know. We'll read your stories on the podcast.
Yes, and send me weird interactions you've had in a bar, and I would love to read them over the air.
What about you?
So I am gonna bring back up a book that I think was already mentioned on the podcast like a while back because you read it. Uh-huh. I'm almost done reading Empire of Pain by Patrick Radden Keefe. If you are unfamiliar, as in you have not listened to the podcast when Sydney talked about the book, or you've not heard about the book at all, it is a nonfiction book telling the story of the Sackler family. The Sackler family is the family that
ruined everyone's
lives. Was largely responsible, essentially just orchestrated the opioid epidemic in America. They created OxyContin. They marketed it under false pretenses that resulted in doctors intentionally being misled as to what the medicine did. And then encouraged over-prescription of this medicine that they were well aware was highly addictive. and essentially just ruined a whole generation in specifically rural blue-collar areas that were already struggling as a result of mining exploitation and just being underrepresented and underserved in these communities. It's a crazy, crazy book. I think that it's at this point somewhat well known that the Sackler family are bad people. It was not until reading this book I realized, oh, they should have been... Well, I don't think I can say what should have happened to them on podcast.
They should have been euthanized. No, I'm just kidding.
They should have done it, you know? they shouldn't ought to have done all that. They really did a lot to demonize addicts in this country, and that's had a huge lasting effect. They did everything that they could in order to make profit at the expense of people who were less fortunate than them. It was a really, really brutal time.
They basically created pharmaceutical marketing in the way that it is today, which has made it very much a business, and it's not really the pharmaceutical industry is very business oriented, very capitalist market oriented, and it is less about the actual products and more about the marketing. That's such a big aspect of the pharmaceutical industry, and it was kind of created by one of the Sacklers. He forever changed the landscape of medical marketing.
Yeah. And it's like they also really shined a light on how susceptible doctors are to propaganda, where previously it was kind of seen that a lot of doctors saw themselves as being above propaganda because they were too smart to get propagandized. And the fact that they assumed that they could not be misled made them significantly easier to be misled. To the point that... So, I don't know if you've read the book. I don't know if you remember this. The average amount of money that Purdue had to spend on a doctor in order for them to prescribe more Oxycontin was a $20 dinner. All it took Purdue in order to make a doctor prescribe more Oxycontin and ruin people's lives was on average a single $20 dinner. And this was a group of people that were like, I am too smart to be susceptible to influence. I cannot be misled because my judgment is too good. Oh, what's that? A $20 bill? Yeah. You know what? I guess I will prescribe more opiates.
And the doctors ended up making a lot of money because they were prescribing the opiates. And whether they thought they were taking a moral high ground or not, they weren't.
I really recommend the book. I think that if you're someone who is aware of the situation, but you're not aware of all the details, it's really eye-opening to see just how bad of a situation and how coordinated of an effort this whole thing was. I think that it really puts in perspective the entire healthcare, pharmaceutical industry and the direction that it has been going in since as early as the 1950s, essentially. And if you're someone who is not that familiar with it, I think that it can be really informational in terms of understanding why the cultural landscape is what it is when it comes to drug users and poor people and stuff like that. You really start to see how this backlash and this outcry that started happening during the opioid crisis, where addicts were being blamed for being morally repugnant and stuff like that. Like, all of that was created in order to still be able to sell addictive products.
And so they could defend the fact that people were getting their lives ruined. They were saying,
well, yeah,
we didn't ruin their lives. They did. They have a pre-existing behavioral health condition or something. They're yeah. sick. That's why.
Literally just pushing the narrative that their pills were not inherently addictive. It's just that some people have the personality that means they will be addicted to anything. Like, they're like, mm-hmm. oh, you could be addicted to watching TV, man. And that's not on us. It's not my fault that I made a drug more powerful than morphine and then constantly pushed higher doses while fully aware that the dosing schedule I was giving was such that everybody taking the medicine was constantly going through withdrawal cycles. It's truly nuts. It really put a lot of things into perspective for me that I think I already understood and felt similarly to the direction that this book kind of pushes you to feel and to think, and some of the beliefs that it asks you to call into question were beliefs that I already had, I generally would say. But just the scale of it and all of that is so it really has just bummed me out. It's bummed me out so bad to read this book and be like, oh yeah, they kind of basically got away with this. Like, they kind of just did this and then it was fine, actually. They hired up Rudy Giuliani as a lawyer, and you know, it could have been a lot worse.
Yeah. I just think if you're someone, sorry, this is Samuel's book that he's talking about, but because I've read it too, I just also want to say, like, if you're interested in the topic, but you don't really read nonfiction and you're worried about that, like, it truly doesn't feel like a boring nonfiction book that's maybe more like textbook style or whatever. Like, it's very like narrative driven, and it's thrilling. Like, at times it almost reads like a fiction because I think it just helps that the events that were happening are so absurd that you're like, what?
yeah, it is truly like constantly revealing new information, and you really, I think that a lot of nonfiction becomes better when it is focused on individuals rather than events, because mm-hmm. it then feels a lot more like a character-driven story.
Yeah.
And this is very much focused on who are the Sacklers? Who have they been? Who are they now? Mm-hmm. And learning about these people is, it's very eye-opening.
Yeah. There's a very handy family tree at the beginning that you can refer to anytime you're getting confused about all the names. I did that often.
Yeah, because there's a lot of them.
There's a lot of them.
Then, by and large, all scumbags, but...
Yeah, I think the youngest ones, like, didn't have a ton. They kind of didn't have a ton to do with all this, so I don't know where they're at and what's...
Yeah, but, I mean, I think that it is a really good... It's a really good example of the easiest way to become an evil person is to have rich parents.
Yeah. That, at least in this case, was definitely true. And I don't know, I wonder, like, the youngest generation of Sacklers who were born into this, like, dynasty family, but it was, like, post the height. Like, it were born since, like, 2010. Into this yeah. family, like, what are they like now? Because I don't know.
It's really become like the family name has started to become a lot of an albatross around their neck, I would assume.
Mm-hmm. Anyways,
but with family names and prescription drugs out of the way, let's spend some time talking about someone else who struggled with addiction, I guess. God, that sucks as a transfer.
Wow.
like I said at the beginning, this is going to probably be a lot. I will see if maybe I can cut it down if it ends up going too long, but there's just a lot of context related to this book that I had to kind of get through in order for the entire thing to start falling into place and making sense as to what is going on. So I'm going to start with just a background on Dostoevsky as an author. He was born November 11th, 1821, so he just recently passed the marking of his birthday. R.I.P. Dostoevsky, sorry that we didn't give you a shout out, big man. He was born in Moscow. His dad was a doctor, and so he lived at a hospital for poor people while he was growing up. His family was relatively well off, but not incredibly well off, because this is 1820s Russia. The world is kind of divided into really, really structured social classes. And so his family, while not being like serfs or peasants or anything like that, they definitely were not in the high reaches of society. So he was kind of like lower middle class, I guess would be the way that his family station would be described. But when he was 14, he got sent to a military engineering university along with his brother. His parents were basically trying to push him into getting a career in the military because that was one of the few ways that allowed you to climb the social ladder in the society. But between getting their official admission and the time that they got to the university, their mother died. So his mom died when he was 14. Dostoevsky did end up getting admitted to the university, but his brother failed to get admitted and went to a different academy. Dostoevsky mostly disliked his time there, mainly because he was always been interested in the arts more than STEM stuff. And as you could potentially imagine, a military engineering university does not spend a lot of time talking about art. It's mostly just STEM. I have a quote from one of his friends at the military academy that kind of describes how Dostoevsky presented himself and how other people viewed him while he was at the academy. And I'm going to have you read that, Sid.
There was no student in the entire institution with less of a military bearing than F.M. Dostoevsky. Dostoevsky. He moved clumsily and jerkily. His uniform hung awkwardly on him. His knapsack...
I think it's shako, and it's a type of hat.
His knapsack, shako, and rifle all looked like some sort of fetter he had been forced to wear for a time, and which lay heavily on him. They said he looked like a dork.
This dude looked so stupid. He's constantly unwashed, unkempt.
He's not a military guy.
Around age 17, while he was still at the university, his father died. So he and his brother both were parentless from the age of like 17-ish onwards. This is allegedly when he first started having seizures. So we know Dostoevsky was epileptic. We don't know for a fact when he first started having seizures, but according to reports from his daughter that happened like later on in his life, allegedly this is around the time when he first started having seizures. He graduated, and at the age of 21, he took a job as a lieutenant engineer, but also began that same year to translate books and journals into Russian as a side job. None of this really did very well for him, and so he was relatively poor during this time of his life. He then decided to take more of a stab at pursuing art as a career, and so his first book came out when he was 23. It got a really good review from a famous critic and was commercially successful enough that he actually sent in a resignation letter so that he could focus on being a writer as a career. Unfortunately, he and that same critic had a really big falling out. And so the critic then started writing negative reviews for everything that Dostoevsky started writing. The negative press on that led to him having an even worse time financially. And this is when we know for sure he was having seizures somewhat frequently.
That's really petty, honestly. Like, you're going to ruin someone's career because of a falling out? Like, that's...
yeah, ruin the career of a 23-year-old.
Yeah, like, that seems a bit much.
He then became friends with some people and ended up joining this social circle that was basically like-minded people who all had an interest in utopian socialism. It was almost like a commune, and this helped him get by. And so when the circle dissolved around 1846, he went on to join what was called the Petrushevsky Circle. This was another commune-style group that was more literary in focus, and it was full of, like, progressives and utopian socialists and stuff like that. Unfortunately, this group got turned into the cops because they were reading and distributing banned books, and so at 27, Dostoevsky got arrested, along with all the other members of the group. And there was a lot of fear that groups like this would lead to a revolution, because there had only a couple of decades earlier been a revolution in Russia around the same time. There had been a revolution in other parts of Europe. There was a lot of fear among the ruling class that groups that were thinking critically of the government were going to lead to another revolution in Russia. And so they decided to make an example out of this group. They all got sent to a high security prison and sentenced to death. They actually got so far as to all of the people were brought in front of a firing squad and were lined up in groups of three. Dostoevsky was in the second group that was going to get killed. And when the first group had been lined up in front of the firing squad, a letter arrived that stayed their execution. So he came probably within like 5 minutes of getting executed by the state. Instead of getting executed, they all got sentenced to hard labor and imprisonment. So Dostoevsky got sentenced to 8 years of hard labor in Siberia. This later got reduced to 4 years. And he was so way the hell out there that it took 25 days of travel by sleigh in order to get to his prison. He obviously did not have a very good time in prison, and I have a quote from him that he said later on to describe his experience with prison that I'm also going to have you read, Sid.
In summer, intolerable closeness. In winter, unendurable cold. All the floors were rotten. Filth on the floors, an inch thick. One could slip and fall. One could slip and fall. We were packed like herrings in a barrel. There was no room to turn around. From dusk to dawn, it was impossible not to behave like pigs. Fleas, lice, and black beetles by the bushel. Yeah, sounds pretty bad.
Yeah, it was like not great. Apparently, people were getting sick all the time. There was like over, I can't remember the exact number, so readers correct me if I'm wrong. It was like 2,000 people in the prison and they all shared one bathroom.
Ew.
So things got pretty gnarly, and additionally, the entire time that he was there, he had both his hands and feet shackled, and the only thing he was permitted to read was the New Testament. They gave everybody a copy of the New Testament, and you could read your verses, but that was it.
Forget the Old Testament.
He got released. Like I said, he only served 4 years. Four tough years. I'm glad I didn't serve those 4 years, but still only 4 years. And then was released in 1854 at 32 years old and had to go straight into mandatory military service as like the second half of the punishment for participating in the literary group.
Oh, even though he looked like a dork in a military uniform.
He was a total dork, but they did force him to participate in the military just to add insult to injury.
His 20s really have not been great.
Well, he's been basically all of them either poor or in prison, which is maybe the two worst ways to spend your 20s.
No wonder his books are so depressing.
While in the town he was serving in, he became friends with a married couple, and he actually ended up falling in love with the wife of the couple. Fortunately for him, the very next year after he arrived, fell in love with the wife, the husband got sent to a new post for the military and got killed there.
Fortunately.
So Maria is suddenly single, and her son is suddenly in need of a father. Dostoevsky sent a letter of apology for his seditious behavior to an official in the army and asked for permission to get married and to start publishing books again. This was granted, but he remained under surveillance for the rest of his life. And using that permission, he did get married to Maria in 1857. Although initially she turned him down because she said that they were a poor match and he did not have enough money. But if getting turned down at your proposal was not enough of an indication that maybe their relationship was a little bit rocky, I also have this quote from Dostoevsky talking about the nature of their marriage.
Because of her strange, suspicious, and fantastic character, we were definitely not happy together, but we could not stop loving each other. And the more unhappy we were, the more attached to each other we became. That sounds so healthy.
That's not even a little bit toxic. We hated each other, but also loved each other. And the more we hated each other, the more we loved each other.
Oh, gosh. No one take any advice from this man.
at least not in matters of love. He finally got released from his mandatory military service in 1859 when he was 38 years old due to declining health. At this point, he was allowed to return to Eastern Russia where he was from, and he got to see his brother for the first time in 10 years. He then began publishing again, mainly was writing articles in journals and travel pieces, including one where he got to go and see the World's Fair installation of the Crystal Palace, which we've already talked about a little bit last episode, but he hated it. he was not a very big fan of the Crystal Palace. He thought that it was a symbol to commodification and materialism and stuff like that. We'll definitely get more into this later, but he didn't like it, and he had some choice words about it in the paper that he wrote. While traveling in 1863, he met and fell in love with another woman. But again, lucky Dostoevsky. Later that same year, his wife died and he was single again.
Why is death causing all of this?
Unfortunately, this did make him the sole caretaker for his stepson. And also, the same year, his brother died, and now he had to provide for both his family and his brother's family. Tough road to hoe. Also, this does make him very similar to Kurt Vonnegut. We've got some parallels here, where Kurt Vonnegut did also have to take care of the family of a sibling who died. And I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting.
This is when he published Notes from Underground in 1864. And this was kind of a turning point for him as an author. This is when he started to get a lot more existentialist and experimental with his works. And from this point forward, it's when his books and novels began to become a lot more literarily acclaimed. Basically, if you're thinking of a Dostoevsky novel, it was written after this point. So he wrote this and then immediately wrote Crime and Punishment. He wrote Brothers Karamazov, The Idiot, Demons. All that stuff came after this point.
So this was the first one. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Well, the first, it
was not... Yeah.
New Age Dostoevsky book.
Yeah, it's the first book that people would ascribe to, like, oh, mm-hmm. this is, like, the peak of his career. Like, this was when he really started to climb into being critically acclaimed, broadly mm-hmm. speaking. I'm going to basically speed through the rest of his life because we've gotten to the publication of the book, but there's a couple of things that are interesting. Firstly, he did end up getting remarried when he was 45 years old. He married his 20-year-old secretary.
What's with this guy? his relationships.
As I referenced at the start of this, he had a lot of issues when it came to gambling. And despite the fact that from this point forward, he became very well-known and successful, so much so that he was asked by the Tsar Alexander II to tutor the Tsar's sons. He never really had a lot of money. They talked about having to pawn off his wife's valuables. Apparently, at one point, they were out traveling and gambling, and in order to pay a debt, his wife had to sell her underwear that she was wearing in order to get him out of a pinch. So, like, allegedly later in his life, he was able to get this under control. But yeah, this was like a compulsion that he had that was really tough for him. This is a great moment for me to mention this podcast is sponsored by DraftKings.
It's not. We don't have any sponsors.
And if we did, it would not be a gambling company.
Yeah.
He did keep producing books, like I said, became relatively famous. He was getting asked and accepting roles as vice presidents and chair members of various literary societies. But he did end up dying at 59 years old from a series of pulmonary hemorrhages. He was sick for a lot of his life. Like I said, by the time that he was 38, he was already getting discharged from the military because he was sick. And that, like, never really got better. And so he died relatively young at 59. His final words were him quoting Matthew 3:14-15, which is, "But John tried to deter him, saying, 'I need to be baptized by you, and yet you come to me.' Jesus replied, 'Let it be so now. It is proper for us to do this to fulfill all righteousness.' Then John consented." And after quoting this, he said, "Hear now, permit it. Do not restrain me." Which I think goes crazy. Not a huge fan of the biblical quotation, but it does go crazy to be like, ah, here's death. Don't hold me back.
That is kind of crazy. I love when people, like, actually, like, they've, like, thought about their last words. Like, you know, he was, like, planning it.
He did also, apparently, his last words to his wife specifically were telling her that he loved her and had never loved anyone else, which I think potentially was true. I think that he had been somewhat unfaithful to his first wife, but he did stay married to his much younger second wife until he died. So
yeah.
maybe he did find that happy ever after that did not involve being so irritated with each other that it you got trauma bonded to your ex and you are the trauma.
Yeah, that's good. And then his wife was 34 when he died, so she got to just live her life on from there. So that's... She got to experience love. I mean, I don't know. I guess we don't really know if she was in love, but probably.
She got presumably. To experience
love. And then she had so much more time to do many more things.
Yeah.
So her 20s were better than his.
Outside of having to pawn off her underwear, she had a pretty good time of it. So that basically does it as far as the context needed when it comes to specifically just Dostoevsky and where he was at in his life when he wrote this book. Now, what I want to talk about is an entirely different book. Because Notes from Underground was written basically in response to a different book that had been published really recently before Notes from Underground that had a huge cultural impact in Russia that was felt for many, many decades, and Dostoevsky hated it. He thought it was a piece of shit. That book was What is to Be Done by Chernyshevsky. There's a couple of different things that are called What is to Be Done because other people who were influenced by it wrote things and titled it What is to Be Done in order to reference the fact that they were aware of this book existing. So specifically, What is to Be Done by Chernyshevsky is the book that we're going to be talking about, which I did in fact read.
Oh, wow.
For the preparation of this podcast. So this is the most prep I've ever had to do for an episode. I read two books, folks.
That's really impressive. If you think that you are productive and accomplished, guys, you're not, because you're not Samuel.
Yeah, you're not me. You could never be me, because I am him.
How can you hate from outside the club when you can't even get in?
So I'm gonna do a mini series within this episode specifically about What is to Be Done, where I'm gonna talk about a plot synopsis and what this book is about, because we've got to understand this book in order to understand Notes from Underground. So this is why this episode might be a little bit long, because it's a series within a series, a podcast within a podcast, if you will.
Oh, crazy.
The book opens, here's just like a quick plot synopsis, as quick as I can make it. Book opens with a stranger checking into a hotel. When the hotel staff comes later the day, he's no longer in the room, and there's a story going around town that last night, people heard a gunshot on the bridge, and everybody assumes that there was a drunk or someone else who went out into the middle of the bridge, committed suicide, and fell into the river. Same time, across town, a young woman and man who are unnamed receive a letter that says, I have disturbed your peace of mind. I leave these scenes. Don't grieve. I love you both so much that I am very happy at my decision. Farewell. Then the young woman accuses the man of being a murderer before turning the blame around and saying that maybe actually she's the one who caused a murder to happen. Now we rewind. And we're in the past, and we're following a girl named Vera Pavlovna. She is being courted by this nasty old man who has a lot of money, and her parents are basically planning on selling her off to him so that they can get a lot of money from having a rich son-in-law. She ends up meeting a med student. The two of them fall in love because they have equally matched intellects and share a lot of views when it comes to feminism and equality. And they run away to get married to each other. They have an interesting relationship that's really built on equality and independence, where there's like a lot of rules of like, you have to have permission to go into each other's rooms. You've always got to dress up to see each other. You have to ask permission before you have anyone over. Like, really progressive and over the top stuff that's like, wow, that's a lot of equality for an 1830s relationship. Also, that would be a nightmare to live in that situation.
Go too far with the boundaries.
Vera ends up becoming a seamstress. She opens a shop, starts bringing in more young women to join the shop, and this essentially turns into a commune where they are profit sharing and they are offering courses in order for the girls to get educated. And they've brought in her husband's college friend in order to help give lessons to people. Vera and the college friend end up falling in love. Her husband realizes that she's fallen in love with someone else and becomes distraught because he still loves Vera. He then goes off and fakes his own suicide, which is what happened in the beginning. We now realize that it was a fake suicide, and the people that received the letter were Vera and the old college roommate. Vera and the friend, thinking that her husband is dead, now get married, and Vera decides to...
Is Vera's friend a man?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Or the friend. I don't
yes,
know.
Yes, the friend.
You're saying the friend. I was like, oh, this is gay.
No, well, we'll get there.
Oh, this just keeps taking turns.
Vera decides to girl boss as close to the sun as possible, and mm-hmm. she goes to med school because she wants to break the stigma against women becoming doctors. Eventually, young woman shows up in distress, and they're able to teach her, actually, your suitor is a scumbag, and that's why your life sucks.
What?
So she goes off and falls in love with another man. That man is supposedly a, like, company factory owner from America who's moved to Russia recently. He convinces her to join the seamstress commune, and then the two of them get married. He shows up at the commune, and then everyone realizes, actually, this guy is Vera's ex-husband. And so Vera and her ex-husband and this new girl and the college roommate, all four move in together as, like, a polycule.
This is crazy.
So that's what is to be done. There's a couple of specific quotes that I want us to read because these are, like, very important in, like, the whole thing. You're going to see what I'm talking about when I get to it. They're going to be long quotes, but you're going to have to bear with me. First off, most of Vera's actions are predicted by her having these, like, semi-prophetic dreams that she then acts on. Her final dream that she has in the book envisions this agrarian utopia filled with people of all ages working together to grow food and live in harmony. And this is how she describes that place.
There stands a building, a large, enormous structure such as can be seen only in a few of the grandest capitals. No. Now there's no other building like it. It stands amidst fields and meadows, orchards and groves. The fields grow grain, but they aren't like the ones we have now. Rather, they're rich and abundant. Is that really wheat? Whoever saw ears and kernels like these? Now such ears and kernels can be grown only in greenhouses. The fields are our fields. But now such blossoms can be seen only in flower gardens. The orchards are full of lemons and orange trees, peach and apricot. How can they grow in the fresh air? Oh, there are columns surrounding them, all open for summer. Yes, these are greenhouses opened up for summer. The groves are our groves. Oak and linden, maple and elm. Yes, the groves are just like ours now. Great care has been lavished on them. There's not a single diseased tree, but the groves are just like ours. They alone have remained the same as they were before. But this building, what on earth is it? What style of architecture? There's nothing at all like it now. No, there is one building that hints at it. The palace at
Sydenham.
What?
Sydenham.
Sydenham?
Mm-hmm.
Cast iron and crystal. Crystal and cast iron. Nothing else. Is that the Crystal Palace?
The Crystal Palace, which was in Sydenham. And this is getting at why Dostoevsky was like, oh yeah, I would use that shit as a chicken coop. Because they're imagining this Crystal Palace in this agrarian society where it's being used as a greenhouse. And he's like, I would live in it like it was a chicken coop because it's a chicken coop to me.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Another noteworthy quote happens where a lot of the times the author will take these asides to talk to the reader, very akin to Northanger Abbey. The author is trying to tell you what his ideas are just throughout the course of the book, having conversations with the imaginary reader, which I will... I'll send this one and I'll have you read it. I'll probably end up cutting some of it out because it is pretty long, but I'll have you read it and we'll see.
Okay.
And I think that it is important to read this with a rather smarmy attitude. This guy is very like, huh, well, I bet you didn't see this coming.
I bet. That up until the last sections of this chapter, most of the public considered Vera Pavlovna Kirsanov and Lopakov. Sorry, guys. Sorry, I don't speak Russian.
Yeah, which I should note, Lopakov is her husband. Kirsanov is the college roommate that Vera ends up falling in love with.
Consider them to be heroes, people of a higher nature, perhaps even idealized figures, maybe even inconceivable in reality because of their very great nobility. No, my friends, my mean, base, pitiful friends, you're quite mistaken. It's not they who will stand too high, but you who stand too low. Oh, gosh. Now you see that they're simply standing at ground level. They appear to be soaring above the clouds because you're sitting in some godforsaken underworld. All people should and can stand on the same level as they. Superior natures, which you, my pitiful friends, and I cannot keep up with, aren't like this at all. I showed you a faint outline of the profile of one of them. There, you see very different features, but you can become an equal to the people described here in full if only you wish to work a bit on your own development. Okay. This guy is taking shots. Okay. Anyone who is beneath them is very low indeed. Come up out of your godforsaken underworld, my friends. Come up. It's not so difficult. Come out into the light of day where life is good, the path is easy and inviting. Try it. Development. Observe, reflect, read those books that tell you about the pure enjoyment of life and about the fact that man can be kind and happy. Read them. Such books gladden the heart. Observe life. It's so interesting. Reflect. It's so fascinating. That's all there is to it. No sacrifices are needed. No deprivations required. They're all unnecessary. Desire to be happy. That's all. Only desire is needed. To obtain it, you'll take delight in devoting yourself to your own development. That's where true happiness lies. Oh, what delights accrue to the developed individual. Even things that another person experiences as sacrifice or sorrow, he experiences as satisfaction and enjoyment. Oh, his heart is wide open to joy, and he has a great deal of it. Try it. It's good.
There's a lot to unpack there.
It's so funny that Dostoevsky wrote a novel about a guy living underground. That's hilarious. That's a clapback of the century, I think.
Yeah, so I want to talk about that, but before we talk about that, I've got a second quote that's going to be right in there with it. This is when the main character is describing her viewpoint of the world, she says this.
That was crazy. Okay. Yes, I will always do what I want. I will never sacrifice anything, not even a whim, for the sake of something I do not desire. What I want with all my heart is to make people happy. And this lies my happiness. Mine! Can you hear that? You in your underground hole? Oh my gosh.
So Dostoevsky read this and said, fuck you, I'm staying in here.
That's hilarious.
So, like, you can see why this is so important to talk about, to understand the context of Notes from Underground, because the whole point of the guy being underground is because Chernyshevsky said, if you don't aspire to these heights, it's because you're too lowly. You must be an underground man, kind of a mole man who lives underground. Dostoevsky just said, all right, bet.
He said, what if I am?
So what? I love my hole. So what?
Also, like, this guy who wrote this book, first of all, I mean, I didn't read it. You did. But that was a crazy plot. And for what?
So the whole point of it, and it kind of gets into it in the, like, he's talking to the audience. Chernyshevsky strongly believed that in order to achieve utopian happiness, all we had to do was educate people. And if we educate people, then people understand that some things are good for them and some things are bad for them. And we are able to strive towards the things that are good for us. And as a collective society, we make our life's a utopia. All you got to do is read and you understand that happiness comes from fulfillment and education and not from dirty down stuff like gambling and cheating and shit like that, which comes up a lot in Notes from Underground, where all of that is like directly referenced. One of the things that it talks about in here in this quote that is again directly referenced is talking about like, if you're educated enough, then even if you experience sorrow, then you can feel it as enjoyment and satisfaction and stuff like that. So like, this opened up this whole way of viewing the world and this whole idea of like life philosophy that we can create utopia simply by working together for the common good. And as long as the leaders among us, the smart and educated people, are constantly pushing for the betterment of everyone and the education of everyone, eventually the world will be a perfect place to live. And Dostoevsky said, bullshit.
He's like, look, I spent my 20s poor and in prison.
Yeah.
And that could not turn that into joy. You know, it's kind of crazy because, yeah, this is the person who's like, oh, you're depressed. Have you tried joy instead?
Oh, you're homeless. Have you tried buying a house?
I don't know. Like, read a book or something. There's so many books.
So I do want to, now that we've gotten through that, retouch on Dostoevsky just a little bit, because it does cast him in a pretty negative light to say he wrote an entire book that is opposed to the idea of utopia.
Yeah, I think it's kind of funny. I like how messy that was.
Essentially, for his entire life, Dostoevsky had pretty complicated relationships and views when it came to politics and philosophy, and all of it was really deeply entwined with the fact that he was a rather religious person who kind of viewed the progress of society and the way in which to make society a better place was going to be through spiritual enlightenment a lot of the time. And so a lot of his views were very contradictory in that sphere, which led to it being a little bit tough to pin down what exactly he believed all the time. But something that he was very clear about is that he was opposed to extremes in thought. So he didn't like the idea of revolution, and he also didn't like the idea of a monarchy and like all this stuff. In this specific context, I think the viewpoint that's important to note is that he was opposed, generally speaking, to the idea of collectivism as a whole. He kind of thought, well, in order for collectivism to work, you have to live in a society of high trust, and there's always going to be people in society that you can't trust, and so it makes it almost impossible to convince everyone else to behave in a collective manner when they know they can't trust everyone in society. And additionally, there's always going to be someone or some groups of people who are going to act against societal expectations, even if the expectations result in betterment for everyone. There's always going to be people who rebel against those expectations simply because they refuse to be held to any expectation, no matter what it is. Yeah. And that's basically it. That's what I have that I think the most succinct version that I can come up with of what the hell is Notes from Underground about. Mainly, it's a diss track, is what it is.
I want more of this. If we have any authors that listen to this, start parodying or making fun of other authors that you don't like.
Yeah.
More often.
Please. Exactly.
They write a book. Colleen Hoover puts out a book that sucks. Do a parody of it. Dare you.
It is like I said, and I hope that you and the audience can appreciate this. not knowing that this is just a parody of another book, that he's straight up ripping another book to shreds mm-hmm. with this, makes it a lot more vague as to what's going on in the book. But mm-hmm. if you actually read the book, like, it's got a whole subplot about a prostitute in it, and that's why he's got the whole section about a prostitute. It's got the whole thing about bettering your social standing, which is why the prostitute in the book believes that she can, through social mobility, climb from her station as a prostitute, whereas the guy from underground is like, no, you can't do that because you're a dirty you're a dirty woman of the night, and it's actually illegal for you to be respected in this world.
It's illegal.
And so I think that that's all that we really need in order to get into next week's episode. Mm-hmm. If there's some cool context that you guys in the audience think I missed, let me know, because I really enjoyed researching for this one. I tried my best to include everything that was relevant, but like I said, it's complicated. This is maybe one of the more philosophically minded books that we've read. Mm-hmm. And it is tough to nail down a succinct context when it comes to a philosophical argument. There's a lot of moving pieces out there.
Mm-hmm. What did you think of, what was the name of the other book?
What Is to Be Done.
What Is to Be Done? What did you think of What Is to Be Done?
It's really heavy-handed. Like, it's fine, but it is so overly sweet, where it's like idealized everything, like, oh, this is a perfect mm-hmm. relationship between man and woman, and a perfect understanding of when there are differences, and also this woman is so powerful, she's created a perfect commune and also has become a doctor, and now they have such beautiful hearts that they reaccept her ex-husband into their relation. Like, it's just,
but then we're supposed to think that they're the lowly people still after all that?
Well, it's not that you're supposed to see them as being lowly. You're just supposed to see his point that he's trying to make is that this is what the average person should be. And if you think that they are above average, that's because you're below average.
Or underground.
You're underground. Wow. You're living in a hole, a hovel.
I mean, how many stars did you give it?
It's like a 3-star book. It's fine. I wouldn't. I think that if you are a real diehard Dostoevsky fan, it's worth reading to have a better appreciation for Notes from Underground. Mm-hmm. I think, but it's not necessary. It is interesting from like a Russian historical standpoint of like this. This one book had such a heavy influence when it came to Russian society from this point forward. At least when it comes to like high society, political philosophy, and stuff like that. So if you're interested in that, I think that it's worth reading the book. Hmm. But if you're not interested in any of that, it's not like so astounding of a book. Like, it's not super well written, and even the people who like it say it's not super well written. It's just that the ideas within it were very influential.
Mm-hmm. It's just so funny to be like Dostoevsky like took that book personally, like he was like personally offended. And then he was like
Yeah, apparently he originally was planning on just writing a series of journal articles about how much he disliked the book, and then was like mm-hmm. nah, I got too much to say, and then turned it into a novella.
Hmm. Hmm. That was very interesting. Thank you. Thank you for reading a whole other book.
So, that is going to do it for us for this week. It's been a little bit of a longer one, not as bad as I was thinking that it could be, but a little bit longer, so we're going to skip the game for this week, but we'll play another one next week. So, thank you so much for listening to me ramble about the context behind a mid-17th century book. I hope that you enjoyed learning about it as much as I enjoyed learning about it. And yeah, like I said, thanks for listening. Please tell a friend, rate us 5 stars wherever it is that you are listening. Leave a comment if you have any thoughts, suggestions, or fun trivia bits. I love fun trivia bits. So if you've got any of that, be sure to comment one so that I can learn something from the comments of this episode. Our intro and outro are remixes of the song 48 by Culla. And Sydney, if people would like to get in touch with us somewhere other than the comments section, where can they do that?
We are on Instagram at the Satire Fire Pod, P-O-D. And we are on TikTok, Blue Sky, and YouTube at the Satire Fire. So you can follow us at any of those places, subscribe. Appreciate it when you also engage with any content, like, comment, share with, if you think we're funny, share it with someone, I don't know. whatever you want to do. And yeah, you can also DM us, like I said, for Knoxville Brewery recommendations. So. I'll be patiently waiting for.
But that has been this week's episode of the Satire Fire Podcast. Be sure to come back next week when we're going to analyze, rate, and review Notes from Underground. You get to hear what our official thoughts are about how good this book is or is not. But between now and then, don't forget to support your local library. I am Samuel.
I'm Sydney.
And we'll talk to you next week. Bye.
Bye.
I've just about come to the end of the road. Here, I've just about lost patience. You people, you get your ass out into the mountains or someplace or hide in there and watch that damn tube. But if not, fuck it. I'm done. In fact, my sermon